Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
You know, folks, every once in a while you will hear something on the radio dial that just grabs your attention, something different that maybe speaks right to some of the thoughts that you've had in the back of your mind for a long time. We hope, we think that that is this show. It's called Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton with a slight case of laryngitis. That guy over there in perfect health is Bill Schaefer. You know, none of us are getting any younger. So what about those things that you've always wanted to do? What happened to the kind of life you always wanted to live? Well, this is the program that proves it is never too late and that no matter what your situation might be, there's always something you can do to start growing bolder.
And you picked a great day to tune in because on this program, you're going to hear from one of the most read, most enjoyed columnists of our time. And we'll find out how Dave Barry is dealing with all those years that just keep seeming to fly by. We're going to talk to a woman who has tips on how we can age to perfection. And we'll meet another who's actually done it, a 90-something who flew fighter planes in World War II. Real people with real stories who found a way to live their lives to the fullest, anxious to help the rest of us learn how to do it too. And that's what we call growing bolder. Absolutely one of our all-time favorite hits, a very unusual cut, Proofreading Woman, from an unusual band called the Rock Bottom Remainders. And as you can probably guess, the lead singer also has a day job. In fact, he's written more than 30 books, including several bestsellers and several that aren't, but should be. Two of his books have even been made into movies.
Yeah, you probably remember him as a fabulous columnist for all of the best newspapers in the country, who for many years pointed out the absurd and intriguing found in day-to-day life. And now he's turned his attention to something far more important, as you can tell from the title of his latest book, or can you really? It's called You Can Date Boys When You're 40. Dave Barry on parenting and other topics he knows very little about. It's a collection of humorous essays. Always a lot of fun to talk to as we welcome back to Growing Bolder, Mr. Dave Barry. Hey, Dave, how are you?
Fine, except I can't believe you played that song to open this segment of me singing Proofreading Woman.
You are no doubt doing a satellite tour of some sort to hype this book. Do you think there is anybody else in the entire country that is going to play that?
No, you would be the only ones willing to risk having no listeners left.
And Dave, if I may go ahead and let the cat out of the bag, do you know, Mark, that Queen will be touring and they chose Dave Barry as the new lead singer?
Oh, that'll be,
that's right.
That'll be exciting.
That would be exciting.
Let's start with the title, because the people that read your books know that the title often has absolutely nothing to do with what's inside the cover. Is that the case this time, or did you?
Yeah, I wanted to give it a more general title. One of them, the branding one, I was going to go with Dave Barry, a Dave Barry book by Dave Barry.
Nice.
But they didn't like that. And the other one I suggested was Dave Barry, you probably thought he was dead. They didn't like that one either. So they went with this one, which is the first essay is, in fact, about my daughter Sophie, she was 13 when I wrote that essay. She's 14 now. And she went through puberty, and we need to find a cure for that in girls. And part of it I kind of was expected. You know, I kind of expected that I wasn't going to have a lot of, you know, there were going to be a lot of times where there's not a bunch of communication going on. Because when kids get to be this age, they mainly spend their time on their phone communicating with every other kid their age. My daughter communicates with every other 14-year-old girl in North America. And what they do is they send pictures of themselves to each other. I don't know why, but they do this very often. Like, here's what I look like now. Here's what I look like now. Here's what I look like. You know, that's mainly their communication. So they don't have time to look away from the phone at you. Because if they were to, you know, look away from the phone for just 10 seconds, they could miss, like, you know, 50 crucial selfies. So I was ready for that. What I really wasn't ready for was the boys showing up. And I used to be a boy. I've been a male my entire life, and I know how we think as a gender. We are scum. We're the worst gender of all the genders. We're the worst. So I don't really want them around my daughter, but they're around all the time now. They're on the lawn. They're on the roof. They're in the trees. They're like squirrels, boys, and I can't stand it.
So, Dave, do you think you're different since you had her after you turned 50? What's it like being a parent when you're older than most of the other parents that you run into?
Well, I don't care for it, aging. There's an essay in there about aging as well, and it's like a little scary because I think, okay, I do this math. I am now 66. She's 14. So I go like, okay, when she graduates from college, I'll be 70. When she graduates from high school, 70. When she graduates from college, I'll be 74, 75. So then when she starts dating, or gets married, I'll be dead. And I have to accept that. I do intend to still be around, be a presence in her life. If she goes on a date, she'll have to take me along in an urn. Like, and the urn would have a sign on it says, "You kids go ahead, enjoy yourselves, don't mind me," you know.
Other than having to deal with those compulsive thoughts, Dave, and I think you probably drive yourself crazy with them, having a 14-year-old daughter has got to give you an interesting look into the culture, because you're a guy who likes to reflect upon that. And in fact, you do write a little bit about Justin Bieber in this new book. You're not a big fan, are you?
No, my daughter last year when she was 13 and younger loved Justin Bieber. She was obsessed with him. Now she's 14 and she doesn't like him anymore. She, even though I spent $100,000 on tickets to the Justin Bieber concert, now she likes something called One Direction, which is even worse because there's five of them. But I did take her to a Justin Bieber concert last year when she loved him, and it was one of the worst experiences of my life. It was in the American Airlines Arena in Miami, and there were 17,000 people in there, of whom maybe eight were dads, and the rest were screaming girls. And they make this noise that theoretically they're happy, they're overjoyed, they're in love, they're with it. But the noise they make is the noise you would make if your feet were being gnawed off by weasels. It's like, "I love you!" Tears streaming down their face. They're very loud, and Justin Bieber whips them into a frenzy, running around. He never holds still. It's like a track meet. He runs all over the stage, back and forth with his dancers, backup dancers running around behind him. And at one point, the place went nuts. He took off his shirt, which I didn't get. I mean, everybody got very excited, but he is not Channing Tatum under there. He looks like the Geico Gecko, physique-wise.
He's not even Carol Channing.
There's a reference.
Hey, speaking of that reference, Dave, despite you kind of have a dire viewpoint of age, it's kind of a contradiction, though, isn't it? Because at this point in your career, you seem sharper, wittier, funnier than ever. Are you writing some of your best stuff now?
What a leading question. Why, I think I am, yes. How could I possibly answer that question? I mean, I can't say yes, I think I am. I have to use false modesty here and say, well, I'll just defer to you on that.
It's more like, Dave, maybe you're seeing the world, you know, through sharper eyes than ever, you know, because you've got the more experience behind you.
Well, or also, I don't really have to care as much, maybe.
Yeah, well,
I'm old, you know. It's kind of nice to be old. You can be cranky and you can say, I don't care anymore. I'm old. I'm going to be dead soon anyway.
And then look what you did. You know, you're in your mid-60s. You live in Florida. How stereotypical can you get?
That's true. I moved here when I was a younger man. I moved here in 1986 from the United States. But I moved here because it's great material. This is a rich source of, this is the mother lode of humor material. Things happen here, true things happen here that you could not possibly make up. I don't know how much time we have.
We've got a minute.
A minute, okay. This truly did happen. A guy who was the chief of police of Homestead, a city south of Miami, was speaking at a Citizens Crime Watch meeting. Citizens Crime Watch meeting! He's the chief of police. And he almost gets hit on the head by a 75-pound bale of cocaine falling from the sky, okay? Smugglers came over. They were being intercepted by a customs jet, and they're throwing cocaine out the back, and they almost killed the chief of police. Now, that really did happen. Where else would that happen? That could not possibly happen in Cleveland.
Well, now, folks, you know where the guy gets his inspiration. He is incredible. The book is called You Can Date Boys When You're 40. Just one of many great books that you're going to want to check out. Our thanks to Dave Barry for keeping us laughing so long that we can't even remember how old we are. Dave, thanks so much.
Wow, man.
Up next, she was a wasp in World War II, and now she's in her 90s, but oh, can she still sting. This is Growing Bolder.
But I gotta know for sure. Come on and hold me tight. You move me. Wow.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
This is Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton, and that is Bill Schaefer. And folks, you're about to meet one of the most energetic, passionate, life-loving 90-somethings you would ever meet.
Does anybody bring more of those to people than we do? It's amazing. And Betty Wall Strofus, you wait till you hear her story. She was a hero in World War II. Yep, and the contribution that she and the rest of the WASPs made back then, well, it should never be forgotten. That's why she spends so much time out on the road talking to whoever will listen so that she can tell you the fascinating tale of women overcoming prejudice and discrimination and facing up to that task with courage, bravery, and patriotism.
Oh, I tell you, I like to fly airplanes.
As far back as she can remember, Betty Wall Strofus was fascinated by flight. But she had no idea she was about to become part of its history. The year was 1942. World War II was raging. America was desperate for pilots. Uncle Sam put out the call to women for help. Out of the 25,000 who responded, just over 1,000 actually earned their wings as Women Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs. Betty Wall was one of them.
How'd a nice girl like you end up doing what you did?
Well, we had a lot of nice girls in the service then.
Did people look at you funny, look at you different?
Thought I was crazy. Well, fly airplanes, why women don't fly. I said, women do fly. We could fly anything they had. We flew 77 different types of aircraft. Not me alone, but our group. We flew 77 different types of aircraft.
How good were you, Betty?
Oh, I was good. Well, you see, I like to fly, and I don't mean to brag. I was very lucky that I was able to do this work because I love to fly airplanes.
Many times she found herself engaged in some pretty fierce training battles against the men.
How'd you do?
Well, I did pretty good. Scared the hell of them.
They didn't like you, did they? You showed up a lot of fellas.
Well, you know, the only thing is I wanted to show them that I could handle the airplane. They were very skeptical. I understand. We were the first women to fly those aircraft, and they weren't sure that they liked having us flying them, and I understood that. But I showed them I could do it, and I tried to do it in a nice way so they would like me afterwards.
When the war ended, Betty put that part of her life behind until a simple incident, 3 decades later, reawakened her fighting spirit.
Lived in Mesa for a while. It was in the 70s, and I have a jacket with a B-17 on the back, a beautiful B-17. And there was a fellow behind me, and he says, oh, your husband flew B-17s during the war. And I says, no, he didn't. I flew B-17s. Oh, he says, you did not. I said, I'm not going to argue with you. I'll just tell you that that's what I flew during the war.
There were a lot of people who didn't know of the women pilots in World War II. You see, WASPs were never considered an official part of the military. In fact, the families of the 38 who gave their lives had to pay to have the bodies shipped home. Betty and many others believed that full recognition, even decades later, was worth fighting for, to honor the sacrifice, to document the contribution, and to legitimize the legacy of the WASPs in World War II. Once again, Betty had a mission. With the precision of a fighter pilot, she set her sights on Washington.
And you were one of the people that went to Congress.
Yes, I
and
went
fought
one.
For
seven of us.
Fought for recognition.
Yeah.
for the women.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I feel good about it because then they did get we did get recognized as veterans. I don't care, it was 35 years later. They let me fly airplanes. That's what I liked about it.
She still loves to fly airplanes. Recently, an Air Force pilot arranged to take her up in an F-16 fighter. She says it was he who learned the lesson when he gave her the chance to take the controls.
He put his hands up and he's, okay, it's all yours. Oh, boy. Oh, I said, I'll do a gentle turn to start with. I turned it like this, a 6G turn. The old G-suit blew like a balloon. He says, hey, take it easy. I don't have the brown bag. I said, honey, that's all right. You can have mine because I don't need it.
Today, Betty Wall is still in demand, traveling the country, posing for photos, and keeping the legacy alive. But she's 91 years old now and very aware that for her, time is the enemy.
So many people that served with you are passing away now, and their stories are going away with them.
Well, I'm so glad we have the memorial in Washington, D.C., and our girls are supposed to write in and tell their story. And if you go in, push Elizabeth Strofus, why, there you get my story.
And what do you hope we remember from you? What can we learn from what you went through?
That anybody can do anything they want if they work hard enough. I think that's the way it is. That's what I tell the children. I said, follow your dream. You want to do something, do it. Because it's so important for us to do what we'd like to do.
And as for Betty, she plans to take to the skies and spread the word every chance she gets.
Life is short enough, so I'm going to talk as long as I'm living.
Boy, what a trooper, what a laugh, and what a story, Bill. You know, you hear it said a lot of times, folks, but in this case, I think it is absolutely true. They just don't make them like that anymore. Simply one of the most engaging, personable, and driven people we've ever met.
And you know what I love the most about her? The story she told about getting to fly recently in a fighter jet. Can you just imagine this young hotshot pilot asking that little old lady if she'd like to take the stick for a minute? And what does she do? Snaps into a turn at 6 G's. Can you imagine what she must have been like back in World War II? Can there be any doubt after meeting her that every one of those pilots had to reconsider whatever preconceived notions they might have had about the toughness and the abilities of women after meeting Betty? She's one of our greatest guests ever, Mark. Betty Wall Strofus. I'm telling you, that's what we call growing bolder.
Time once again for a quick reminder that life is what you make it, that we all have the ability to find happiness and meaning in our daily lives. All it takes is noticing and then appreciating the little things. Here's our pal, Key Howard.
Webster's Dictionary defines the word irony as an outcome of events contrary to what might have been expected. I found it ironic that one of our greatest American habits was accidentally developed by an adversary of the United States in the War of 1836. After the war and his defeat, this individual arrived in New York from Mexico with a hunk of chicle in his pocket, used in his country as a substitute for rubber. His American host, Thomas Adams, couldn't generate enough interest in the product, so the man returned to his country broke and disillusioned. Several years later, Adam remembered that the man would often pull out a piece of this chicle and chew on it. So using the sample that he'd carefully stored away, he mixed it with hot water, rolled it into little balls, and at a penny apiece, the chicle ball was selling very well. Based on the success, Mr. Adams began manufacturing Adams New York City Gum. He made the earlier formula tastier by adding a little licorice flavor, and he called his product Blackjack. Now, today's gum has little resemblance to the chicle from the trees of Mexico. Modern gum is merely sweetened polyvinyl acetate, a synthetic product made by DuPont. But Americans still chew over 10 million pounds of the stuff a year, all thanks to Mr. Tom Adams and his Mexican visitor, General Santa Anna, the scourge of the Alamo. How ironic. Till next time, this is Key Howard. Ain't life grand?
Up next, things you may have wondered about your own body but were afraid to ask all get answered by the outrageous Mary Roach. This is Growing Bolder.
Embrace the health and longevity movement with the Fountain of Youth monthly e-newsletter. Growing Bolder and the National Senior Games Association have teamed up to bring you the latest videos, podcasts, and articles on inspirational masters athletes and the many benefits of physical activity delivered right to your inbox. Just go to nsga.com/connect to sign up for free today. The Fountain of Youth, because if you want to keep moving, you have to keep moving.
You're listening to Growing Bolder with Mark and Bill. Have you ever had the thought, maybe when you're reading something scientific, something about, say, the human body, that there's a lot more to it, that maybe there's a lot that gets left out because things are considered a little gross, or maybe they make people uncomfortable? Well, our next guest has no problem going where no one else will.
She has a fearless fascination with life, folks, which has resulted in a series of titles like Stiff, Bonk, and Spook. She's also written Gospel Bits, 6 Feet Over, and Packing for Mars. And her latest book may be her best yet. It's called Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. Let's say hello to the always entertaining Mary Roach. Hey, Mary, how are you?
Hello. Very well, thank you.
For those who might have missed human anatomy in college, tell us what the alimentary canal is, and didn't your publisher beg you to call your book something else?
Something other than Gulp?
Well, Adventures of the Alimentary Canal, perhaps?
Well, the alimentary canal is just the whole pie hole and the food chute. It's the whole food, the human food processor. An alimentary canal is sort of an old-timey word for it, but I liked it because it sort of suggests a voyage, like a summer cruise down the Danube or something, the alimentary canal.
Well, we like you, Mary, because you choose topics for your book. You know, we mentioned that you've gone where few have dared to go before. So how do you decide what to spend years of your life diving into?
Oh, it's kind of a process of elimination, no pun intended. I like the taboo topics, the icky stuff. It's the kind of stuff people turn away from. I'm sort of the bottom feeder of nonfiction. If this is the topics other people find, it's maybe beneath them or something. I actually find there's a lot of fascinating things to talk about and things that get overlooked because we're a little bit squeamish. So I like to just take people by the hand and encourage them to dive in and come along on the voyage down the alimentary canal.
And tell us what happens on that voyage. What do readers discover? What do they find? Who is your audience?
Oh, my audience is anybody who's curious about their own body and who enjoys a fun read. It's not in any way a technical or comprehensive physiological guide to the alimentary canal. I spent some time, you know, I start in the nose. I spent some time with a sensory analyst, who's sort of a person who does nose forensics, who can tell you by sniffing your olive oil what went wrong in the process. And so I learned all about the nose and how important that is to eating. Spent some time in Food Valley in the Netherlands at a saliva research lab, also with some folks who do some interesting things with teeth and chewing and oral processing, which is something we never give thought to. You just, you know, you eat and, you know, people just don't give it a lot of thought once they've experienced the flavor. They don't really realize what goes on. It's kind of entertaining. So I was in Food Valley, and then for the stomach, I spent some time in a radiology lab with a guy who brought in a competitive eater and a regular eater and compared them on a fluoroscope, brought in, you know, bucket loads of hot dogs and a side of barium to see what was going on. And so the chapter about how hard it is to burst the human stomach and a chapter on Jonah and the whale, and what, if there are any animals that could survive in other people's, other creatures' stomachs. Spent time at a fecal transplant. Avenal State Prison was the rectum chapter. So I try to take a kind of a fresh approach and maybe an unusual take on these different ports along the way.
So, Mary, maybe we shouldn't be talking about your books right now as much as we should be talking about you. How did you grow up? Where did you find, you know, this, these likes that you've had? I mean, you've had sex for science. You've gone to Antarctica for science. What makes you tick?
I guess I have a short attention span and an overactive curiosity. Maybe, I don't know. I've just maybe don't have some of the filters most people do. I guess I ask questions that might seem odd to be asking, but I just let my curiosity take me where it goes, and I enjoy travel, and I enjoy the world of science. I find scientists are usually really funny, engaged, smart, curious people, and there's a whole world of things going on in the name of science that are, you know, whether it's sex research, you know, the physiology of sex, or, you know, the competitive eaters in the lab study. There's just, there's a lot of science that's really fun and fascinating, and so I consider it kind of a privilege to be able to step into those worlds.
We're talking with Mary Roach, who has written a book about a process that we all partake in several times each and every day, Adventures in the Elementary Canal. And, you ask questions, Mary, that honestly, many of which I've never thought about. But once I see these questions in print where you've put them, now I want to know the answers. I mean, you're asking questions like, can constipation kill you? Why doesn't your stomach digest itself? And how much food would it take to make your stomach explode? Can you give us the answers to any of those questions?
I can give you the answers to all of them, but then you wouldn't have reason to buy the book, so I'll give you an answer to one of them.
All right, that's a fair trade. I'll pick one. How much food would it take for my stomach to explode?
It's actually really tough to burst a human stomach because it has a protective mechanism. It has stretch receptors, and when you stretch it to the breaking point, your stomach will reflexively, against your will or without your participation, it'll empty itself. You will regurgitate. So for that reason, it's very hard to get it past the point where it would break, unless you're dead. If you're dead, you can burst the stomach at around, but you don't have that reflex. About a gallon is usually where, because there were cadaver studies that were done in the 1800s by a guy named Key Aubend, I think was his name, or Key Auberg. Anyway, he set up a bunch of cadavers around a table and filled the stomachs to the bursting point, and it was around a gallon, give or take some.
Mary,
individual.
You're starting to scare me, Mary. But these topics you write about, they're always like they're about body parts, but the way you write about them, it seems like what you're really writing about, Mary, are people. You're offering a much more intimate and a greater understanding of who we are and how amazing even the simplest things we do are.
Yeah, it's about the human body, but it's also about human beings. For example, the guy who brought the cadavers into the lab and filled the stomachs up, I wanted to know more about him. When I can, with historical figures, it's a little difficult, but sometimes you find an archive, like Horace Fletcher, the chewing fanatic. He left all his papers to Harvard. So you could see his papers and you could read them and you could get a sense of who his character was. And I love to do that. And so you're absolutely right. It's very much about the people as well as the parts and processes.
And Mary, in like 15 seconds or so, is there a quick takeaway, something you want us all to keep in mind and understand to learn from you?
Oh, I like people to respect their bodies, but to have fun learning about them. So the books are a lot of fun, but maybe people will come away with a little awe for this crazy machine that you walk around in your whole life.
Well, the book is called Gulp, but folks, there's a whole unique world out there in the Mary Roach universe, and you can find out about it all at maryroach.net. Interesting stuff. Hey, you try to do your best, but are you living a life well lived? What does that even mean? We'll talk about it with the creator of a great new documentary film that's pretty inspirational, next on Growing Boulder.
sign up for the Growing Boulder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingboulder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Boulder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingboulder.com/podcasts.
My guard stood hard when abstract threats to noble to neglect.
I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and this is Growing Boulder, a program that's dedicated to breaking the stereotypes of age. You know, the ones we're talking about. Growing Boulder, it's about helping people of all ages understand that as you move into your 50s or 60s or 70s and on, that you can live a fulfilling life. You can continue to have new and exciting adventures, and you can make a difference.
You know, Billy, I believe it can be the best of our lives. And there's a documentary film out there now that really pretty much has the same message. It's called Lives Well Lived, Celebrating the Secrets, Wit, and Wisdom of Age. It was created by a fascinating person. She's an accomplished award-winning photographer whose relationship with her own grandmother inspired her to try her hand at directing. And guess what, folks? She ended up creating this critically acclaimed award-winning film. Let's find out more as we say hello to Sky Bergman. Hey, Sky, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we're thrilled to talk to you. We love your work. Congratulations on your film. I know it's been incredibly well received. What was it that made you think that this was a topic you wanted to tackle?
Well, really, as you mentioned, it was because of my grandmother. I grew up with my grandmother, and we were the closest of friends. And at 99, she was still working out at the gym, and I thought, oh my God, I better film this because nobody's going to believe that at 99 she's still working out. And I filmed her, and I just, as a throwaway comment, said, Grandma, can you give me some words of wisdom? And that was really how the project began, because I came back from that trip. She lived in Florida, and I live in California, and I put together a one-minute video clip of her at the gym and her words of wisdom. And I thought, I want to find other people out there that are as much an inspiration as my grandmother is to me. And that was started a four-year journey of interviewing 40 people. So it was pretty amazing.
99 and working out at the gym. You didn't think everybody 99 did that, did you?
No, but she had a phrase, move it or lose it. And I so remember that because, you know, there are times for all of us when we think, oh, I don't want to go to the gym, or I do yoga, I don't want to do yoga. And I would think of my grandmother lifting her weights at 99, still at the gym, and that got me motivated.
And is your grandmother still with us?
No, she fortunately enough came out to California when she was 103 and a half and saw a sneak preview of the film along with 850 people in a packed, sold-out theater here and for the San Luis Film Festival. And she passed away peacefully 6 weeks after the screening of the film. She literally said, I'm done, and she stopped eating and drinking, and she passed away in 2 days. I think my mom says she lived long enough to see the film on the big screen. That was her goal, and she did it.
You know what? We love that. You know, that is what we and everybody else calls compressed morbidity. Those who live active, engaged, social lives, typically when they go very quickly. And, you know, we say sign us up for compressed morbidity. You know, it's such a great project, and we really are kind of swimming in the same pond here with Sky Bergman. We're talking to an award-winning documentary filmmaker. When you tell a story of older people, the challenge that we face, and we like to think we do it well, and we know that you do because we've seen your work, is tell a story about older people in a way that appeals to younger people, because that's really kind of the bottom line. We are trying to let people know that what they've been led to believe about aging is not necessarily true. How has a younger audience responded to your film, Sky?
Well, thank you for asking that. You know, right now I'm working on a number of intergenerational projects where we're using the film as a catalyst to connect the generations, because I feel like if I can do something to combat ageism, just one connection at a time, I think that that's very helpful in this world right now. And I think that, you know, younger people, the reason that they're connecting with the film is because in the film there's a lot of historic footage and a lot of footage of the people when they were younger as well. So the students and the younger generation can look at that and see themselves in it. And I think once you see yourself in someone else, it's a common bond. It's a much more universal appeal. this was something that I absolutely had to do, and I was eating, breathing, and living it until I got it out there. So I just made it happen.
We are talking with Skye Bergman, who has a film called Lives Well Lived, Celebrating the Secrets, Wit, and Wisdom of Age. And Skye, I understand that you highlight 40 people in the film from 75 to 100. Now, did you have a standard list of questions that you asked them? How did you get them to tell you what you wanted to hear?
Yes, I think that one of the hardest things when you're interviewing somebody, and this is true for those of you out there that might want to interview a loved one, which I would encourage you to do, is to know where to start. Because if you just say, can you tell me something about yourself, kind of people might have a blank stare. And so I worked for about 6 months coming up, formulating the questions that I came up with, and they are on our website, so you can find those questions there. I worked with, because I teach at a university, I took the people from the social sciences department out to lunch and the person that taught the psychology of aging, and I said, if you were going to do a project like this, what are some of the questions that you would want to ask? So, for example, you know, besides what is a life well lived, one of the questions of what do you wish younger people understood about life, and what do you think of your own mortality? You know, questions like that that I think led people to give me answers, and then you ask the follow-up questions as well. And so as I was going through the process of making the film, I set about making the film because I thought I was going to collect all these words of wisdom of the people that I was interviewing. But in fact, it was that and also their incredible stories of triumph over some really difficult times. And I think that that remaining positive in the midst of adversity was a major theme in what I saw in all the people that I interviewed.
Have you found that those who feel like they have a life well lived and are really old are no longer afraid of death? You mentioned that you talked to them about mortality because, you know, I want to believe that at some point, if we feel like we've left it all out there on the field, we've said what needs to be said, we've done what needs to be done, we've, you know, we're proud of the way we live, that we're not afraid any longer about what's next.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And I think Evie Justison says it best in the film where she said, you know, I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens. And I think that that's the way that really the people in the film felt, that they had really achieved what they wanted to achieve and that they felt pretty good about where they were at and what they had done and the legacy that they were leaving behind. And I also think that it was really important to them. Many of them thanked me for collecting their stories. And you know, it gives, I think one of the things that we don't realize when we collect people's stories is that it gives their life some sense of validity and some sense of meaning that they are leaving something behind. And so I think that's another important reason to collect their stories. But I don't feel like people were that concerned about dying. I mean, they all know what's going to happen. And like they said, they have far less time in front of them than behind them. But I think you're right that when you get to a point where you feel like you've lived a good life, it's a lot easier to let go than if you feel like you still have a lot of unfinished business.
What would you say is the takeaway? What can we learn from this life that you've lived over the past number of years in creating this film?
Well, I think, like I said before, really live life in the moment. And I think the other thing that I learned is to put the cell phone away, put our devices away, and really have human interaction with other people. You will learn so much from them if you really pay attention. And I always say that everyone has a story to tell if we just take the time to listen. And how much better would the world be if we really took the time to listen? And one of the things that I learned in the research for the film was that the last 100 years is the first time in human history that we've looked to anyone other than our elders for advice. And I really feel the world is suffering.
Skye, I have a feeling a lot of people are going to want to see this film. It's called It's called Lives Well Lived, folks, celebrating the wit and wisdom of age. You can learn more at lives-well-lived.com. Skye Bergman, great to meet you here on this program, and we can't wait to find out what your next project's going to be. Up next, the surprising role of sex in increasing your chances of living to 100. This is Growing Bolder.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
Embrace the health and longevity movement with the Fountain of Youth monthly e-newsletter. Growing Boulder and the National Senior Games Association have teamed up to bring you the latest videos, podcasts, and articles on inspirational masters athletes and the many benefits of physical activity delivered right to your inbox. Just go to nsga.com/connect to sign up for free today. The Fountain of Youth, because if you want to keep moving, you have to keep moving.
I think you know by now that you are listening to Growing Boulder. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and we have a tremendous segment for you now. Our weekly surviving and thriving interview with the right kind of care and support and the right attitude. It's possible to not only survive life's greatest challenges, but to thrive in the aftermath. And right now, we're going to give you some specific tips that will help you find out if you're on the right track.
Amen, Brother Bill. Our next guest is an award-winning author and a public speaker who has a degree from George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences. She's co-host of the Staying Young radio show, and she's a regular health and wellness contributor for Fox News Radio. She and two others have written a new book called Age to Perfection, How to Thrive to 100. Happy, healthy, and wise. Let's say a happy hello to Judy Gaiman. Hey, Judy, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
We're doing great. Thanks so much for your time. You know, let's jump right into the book, and let's start with the title of the first chapter. I'm guessing if there's just one thing to remember from the book about how to thrive to be 100, it's the two-word title of that chapter, Personal Responsibility.
Well, that's exactly right, and that starts when you're young. It's, you know, we can't, like, start this at 60 and 70. We can improve at 60 and 70, but we really have to start paying attention even in our younger years, even at 20 and 30 and 40, because these are the times that we make sometimes life-changing errors.
Well, we can pay attention, Judy, but geez, there's so many mixed messages. It depends who we're paying attention to. Conflicting and confusing statements out there about what's good and bad, what'll save you and what'll kill you. How does age to perfection help?
Well, I think you make an excellent point, because there is a lot of bombardment. Do this, take this. Really, what we did in this book, we put a lot of great research behind it. But what I like to say our best research was we went to those people that were over 100, and we said, hey, give us your top 10 list. And we put that, and we included it in the book. And it's interesting that when you compare what they're doing and what they've been doing their whole life, that it goes back to a lot of the research that we really didn't need all these expensive, fancy studies to tell us. We could just ask these people, because a lot of the things that they told us across the board were the same.
Yeah, and they're just doing it by nature, it seems like, many of these people. They didn't read a book. They weren't advised by anybody. You know, a lot of cases, these are relatively poor people, if not poor, certainly austere, and they just go about their lives and don't make the mistakes that many of us do, right?
Oh, well, exactly, because they weren't eating from the barcode like we tend to do these days. We always say, don't eat from the barcode. If it has a barcode, don't eat it. I mean, they were eating fresh fruits, fresh vegetables. You know, even the meats that they were eating, we know where they came from. They were, you know, grass-fed. They were basically organic, because before organic got cool, you know, that old song, country before country was cool, they were organic before organic was cool. And they didn't have all these fancy things that we have now, but they really got to the basics, and they stuck with those basics. You know, exercise on a regular basis, eat lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, spend time with friends, you know, take your attitude into check, take personal responsibility. All these things are so important.
All right, Judy, I told Mark before the interview that I wasn't going to go here, but I think I really want to.
Okay.
You've dedicated in your book an entire chapter to sex.
Chapter 8.
So all right, let us have it. We need to know this. Will sex kill us or help us live to 100? Because it's got to be one or the other.
It's really important. We put chapter 8 in every book, and that's always the sex chapter. So we print T-shirts say chapter 8, because it is so important to health. And being in a monogamous relationship and having an active sex life is so important in so many ways. It helps with hormone regulation. It helps with, it's a natural antidepressant. Just even the feel receptors in our body, we have to have that human touch. There was a study a long time ago where they took these kids in the Romanian orphanages that were not thriving. They weren't growing. They weren't thriving. And they put people there just to touch them and hold them. And they noticed that suddenly those kids, they were growing in height. They were putting on weight. Their brains were working. We need to be touched. And too often we, you know, get in our car, we go to work, we sit at our desk, we go home, and you never touch anybody. You don't touch each other. So the power of touch is really important. And, of course, you have to touch each other a lot when you're having sex. So that's really important.
I think I need to get one of those Chapter 8 T-shirts, Bill. That would be nice to have.
And we can declare you Chapter 8 with a whole new meaning.
I like that. You know, there are so many people our age, when I say our age, 60s and beyond, that, you know, they like hearing this stuff, but in a way it threatens them because you have to work to make these changes. Some people want to believe that it is too late to make these changes. Their life is as it is. But it really is never too late, is it, Judy?
It's not. And this is a very important message for your listeners who are in their 60s. And even if you've made those mistakes at 30, 40, 50, earlier in your life, maybe you were a smoker, maybe you were a drinker, making the changes and the decisions now to get it together does have tremendous health benefits, and it can prolong your life. So it's not too late. This is a message of hope, for anybody who's out there that the things that they do, the things they put in their mouth, the decisions they make each day to get out of bed, have a positive attitude, get moving, eat right, avoid things like artificial sweeteners, things with barcodes, cigarettes, alcohol, all of those things are bad for us. Avoid those things and make good, healthy choices. It's a day-by-day, step-by-step process where you can make a difference in your life, not just in your life, but the influence you have on your spouse, on your children, on your grandchildren. Really important, and we can't overlook that.
And your book, Age to Perfection, doesn't just give us hope. It gives us concrete things to try. Give us a few examples of common habits that are literally killing us.
Oh, well, sitting too much. If we're living a sedentary lifestyle, you know, they say the sitting is the new smoking. We're actually taking years off of our life. So if you're at a desk job, or if you just are one of those people that likes the television, or you just like to sit in your lounge chair and read all day, you got to get moving. Very, very important to the circulation in the body and all around, even your immunity, everything. And that's one thing that people can do that's easy. And most of the things you can do to improve your health don't cost you anything. So if, you know, you're seeing things online or talking to people and they say, you got to buy this, you got to do that. No, you don't. You got to do some common sense things. So obviously that drinking alcohol is just, it kills us on the inside. It is a toxin. We need to either limit it or omit it completely. And smoking, but not just smoking yourself. Avoid secondhand smoke. I mean, believe it or not, there are still restaurants that have smoking sections. Just crazy, crazy, crazy. Avoid secondhand smoke altogether. Just stay away from it. There are so many things just like this in our daily lives that we can do, and just choice. It's all about choices, and we just got to make the better choice. Like I said earlier, artificial sweeteners. Stay away from those diet things. People say, oh, yeah, but the regular soda has too much sugar. Then don't drink soda.
You know, Judy?
Then choose water.
You know, you really hit on something here, and you've put it all together in a great book called Age to Perfection, How to Thrive to 100 Happy, Healthy, and Wise. You make a lot of sense, girl, and we appreciate what you've done to give us all a little boost on our way to seeing how close we can get to being 100. Thanks, Judy.
We've heard from some pretty impressive people on this program, so now it's time to take a minute to think about you. What's your Growing Bolder story? What do you want it to be? Think about it. craft it, and then find a way to start living it.
Stop trying to define people by their age alone. It's a whole new world out there where it's not about age, it's about attitude, and that's Growing Bolder.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, throwing high and mighty traps. Countless fire and flaming rope, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I. So much older then, I'm younger than that now. Half right prejudice leap for, rip down all hate I scream. Lies that life is black and white, spoke from my skull I dream. Romantic flanks of musketeers, foundation deep. Somehow, oh, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. In a soldier's stance, I aim my hand at the mongrel dogs who teach. Fearing not, I'd become my enemy in the instant that I preach. Sisters fled by. Boats mutiny from stern to bow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Deceived me into thinking I had something to protect. Good and bad, I defined these terms quite clear, no doubt, somehow. Ah, but I was so much older.